Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Banter on the Parkway After Dark. It is 11:25 on Thanksgiving Eve, but we are committed to getting that hashtag content out to you guys. So we are here all together huddled around Brad's phone. I'm your host, Brian, from BannersOnTheParkway.com. And I am joined, as always, by Brad. Brad, what are you up to here on this wonderful Thanksgiving Eve?
Well, I'm back at, I guess, the birthplace of Banter on the Parkway, or at least most of us. I've driven 4.5 hours today, mainlined a whole bunch of coffee, ready to go back at the homestead, which is not quite the homestead where we grew up.
We've also got Joel, and Joel, obviously a bittersweet Thanksgiving for you with, you know, this being the first Thanksgiving without Aaron Carter. Can you just walk us through your emotions?
Yeah, I mean, bless up, obviously, the former lead singer of Boyz II Men, great talent, just passed away, gone before his time, taken by the addiction struggles we see so often in pop culture stars.
So, yeah, Braden, obviously this was a little before your time, but Aaron Carter, lead singer of the boy band Boyz II Men, you know.
I don't think that's accurate.
What? Okay, listen, you are 40 and you need to quit rising to this bait so easily. The reason I'm like this is because you're like that. So, like, for both of our sakes, please quit. Anyway, Braden is also here with us, making his season debut. Obviously, last week you were out with Turf Toe. How's that doing?
I think he'd used Turf Toe last year. Or was that Joel?
It's a very common injury.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm on the recovery train from an injury I didn't know I had. And I don't know what kind of recovery you're supposed to have for Turf Toe. But here I am, sitting on the ground.
You're back in good voice.
You keep your toes off the turf.
I don't know if I could identify Turf Toe if I saw it. But anyway, we are here to talk about Xavier basketball, kind of. And so Xavier was in action last week. Last week it was Xavier 78, Fairfield 65. Xavier really kind of struggled to get going in this game without Colby Jones. Joel, what did we did we learn about Xavier in this game? Fairfield was in the game for quite a while. Did that teach us anything about Xavier or about Fairfield, or maybe just that Colby Jones is very good at basketball?
Yeah, I think it was just a reminder that almost all Division I teams are, if not dangerous, then at least passable at basketball. This did not feel like a very good game for Xavier, but at the end they came out with a 13-point victory in a game that KenPom said they were going to win by 14. So it was like running in wet sand for most of the game. But, you know, class won out, and Xavier eventually did what they needed to do. Arguably just barely to come away with that one. Obviously, Jack Nungy had a really good game. He had like a 23-7-2. Zach Fremantle got what I'm going to call the first triple-double of this year. I'm sure there's more coming that his way. But he looked really good. He was the maybe steadiest player that Xavier had. Ended up shooting 6 of 12 from inside the arc. He kind of showed up all over the place, had a little bit of turnover problems, but he adapted his game to what that game needed. And basically on the back of the two big men and some efficient contributions from the guards, Xavier ended up walking away with a game that shouldn't have been as close as it was halfway through.
I think the other thing we learned is that Xavier doesn't have a like-for-like replacement for Colby Jones. Cam Kraft maybe will eventually fill that role. He's certainly aggressive on the glass and has gotten himself in good positions so far, but he just hasn't been able to make it happen offensively yet. And Jerome Hunter, I think, would probably be the best person to put in there for long minutes, but he just cannot stop hitting the guys on the other team. I don't know what has gotten into him this year, but he's got some sort of borderline pathological addiction to violence at the moment, and he managed to get 7 minutes against Fairfield when Xavier could have used a lot more than that out of him.
And in those 7 minutes, Hunter collected 3 fouls. I will say probably one thing, and we're going to talk a little bit about the similarities and differences between this year's team and last year, But one of the things we saw this year was in a game that they weren't playing great against a team they should have been thumping, they shot a grand total of 16 three-point attempts. That's probably, I think that's something we would not have seen last year. Maybe I'm just projecting a little bit, but it seemed like their game plan was first, second, and third chuck threes, even when you're not very good at it. And instead, they were able to work inside out and kind of adjust to what Fairfield was bringing to be able to walk away in the second half.
Okay, so then Xavier was back in action on Friday night, and it was really the first big test of the season, and that one ended up Xavier 79, Indiana 81 for Xavier's first loss of the season. So, Braden, was this, you don't want to call it a moral victory, but was this a good sign for Xavier to be in a game late with an Indiana team like that, or a bad sign that they weren't able to close it out?
You can look at it both ways. Obviously, Indiana's a loaded team this year. Mainly Trace Jackson Davis, our inability to stop him on the interior. He obviously went for 30. He only missed three shots inside the arc. I thought that was a huge negative from this game. He's obviously an All-American candidate, possibly could be a player of the year. But we had absolutely nothing we could throw at him. We tried double-teaming him every now and then. He was able to kick out and find open guys. And sometimes he'd just split the double-team and then go and score again. I thought it was encouraging. Like Joel mentioned with the prior game, we didn't start hucking threes. We didn't really lean into that too much. Our good three-point shooters shot the threes for us. Colby Jones returned. He didn't look all the way up to speed, but he still had a pretty solid showing in the time he got. He picked up a few just stupid fouls. Not stupid in that he was dumb in committing them. Refs were dumb for calling them, but I'm going to leave that to one of you guys to talk about the officiating. I wouldn't call it a moral victory, but the fact that we were able to take an Indiana team that's been really highly regarded in this preseason and early in the season and take them all the way with a chance to win with just a few seconds left, I thought it was encouraging, and it was still a letdown to let it get away. I think that's one we're going to want back.
I like how you said you weren't going to describe that as a moral victory and then just went ahead and gave us the definition of a moral victory. I think this game also showed how important Sule Boom is. 25 minutes, he was in and out of the game with foul trouble, and when he was out, didn't look like Xavier had anybody who was able to stay in front of Xavier Johnson, Indiana's point guard. Des Claude, for all of his athleticism and obvious effort, just wasn't a match for him one-on-one defensively. Xavier Johnson ended up with 23 points on 7 of 8 shooting, and especially with Boom out and then with Boom trying to nurse foul trouble, he got wherever he wanted to go on the court and made his way to the free throw line. He has a really janky free throw stroke, but historically he's been a really good free throw shooter, and he was again on the night. We just needed maybe one more perimeter defender, or I thought a few more possessions in a zone defense might have slowed down both Jackson Davis and Xavier Johnson. But there's a reason why Xavier's hired Sean Miller twice and me zero times. So what do I know?
Yeah, because they don't know about you yet. But I do think they should have stayed in the zone. There was a kick out to that one white kid, whoever he was, who played a really mediocre game, but hit one big three-pointer late in the game, and that brought Xavier right back out of the zone. I don't know if he pronounces it Xavier Johnson, or I thought they were saying it Xavier. But anyway, he was part of my favorite moment of the game, in which he was obnoxiously celebrating afterwards, and Adam Kunkel just went and punched the ball out of his hands for no discernible reason other than that he's Adam Kunkel. And then when Johnson turned around and took affront to that, as anyone would, Kunkel acted like Johnson was the one who was acting like a baby for doing that. So I thoroughly enjoyed that, because he knocked the ball out of his hands and then kicked it somewhere. So it was a really nice Adam Kunkel moment. I think Xavier Johnson is something of a D-bag. But yeah, that zone look would have been a little bit better. Jack Nungy was just horrible on defense in this game. There's no real way to walk around that. He was awful on defense, and he didn't have much offensively either. He struggled. Trace Jackson Davis made him look distinctly not even average, less than average. I have no doubt that he'll come back and be much better the rest of the year, and he'll have very good games against very good big men. But this is not one that he's going to scrapbook, or that his new wife is going to bring up at the kitchen table anytime soon.
Okay. And one feature that, just to let you guys know about it, with you know, Joel making some comments there toward Brayden, is one feature of Banter on the Parkway After Dark is that we can hit each other because we're all in the same room. So if you hear something that sounds like someone being struck, it probably is. But looking around kind of the national landscape in college basketball, probably the biggest result from this past week was Texas just hammering Gonzaga, beat them by 19. They've taken over number one in KenPom, although the AP poll only saw fit to rank them fourth after beating the team that the AP poll saw fit to rank fifth. So good job, AP voters. You make a ton of sense. But that is obviously a huge result for Chris Beard and Texas, who are hoping to pick up a pick up kind of some momentum after the Shaka Smart era. Feast week is upon us. The Maui Invitational championship game was tonight. We were watching Tennessee just hammer Butler earlier. It's great to have wall-to-wall college basketball, which we will for the next few days. But one thing that is of interest probably to Xavier fans, Big East fans, is Georgetown was not at a tournament this week. They were at home against American University, and that was a game in which they contrived to blow a 16-point lead and lose. So I guess the question here, Joel, how many NAIA conferences would Georgetown win?
They wouldn't even be the best Georgetown in the Mid-South Conference. My favorite part about the loss to American, other than all of it, was that Georgetown's men's basketball Twitter tweeted out the score reversed in their graphic. So they tweeted a 74-70 Georgetown win. It was not. Brad and I were talking via text early this week about blue bloods that have fallen. I didn't realize how hard Georgetown was trading on the first Ewing era when he was a player, where they were borderline dominant in the mid-80s. And, you know, people who came up in the 80s and 90s kind of saw Georgetown as one of those nationally relevant programs. But they've actually been kind of okay for a while, and they're trending way away from okay. Anybody who's watching this plane crash develop doesn't need that explained to them. They had a chance to fire Patrick Ewing after he went 0 of 19 in the Big East last year, and for some reason they chose not to. You know, in other news of blue bloods who are now approaching room temperature, Louisville is freaking 0-6, 171st in the KenPom, and they just lost by 19 to a dire Cincinnati squad on a neutral court. They were actually good a lot longer than Georgetown was. So KenPom does an overall program ranking for the KenPom era starting in 1997. Louisville is 12th in that. Georgetown is in the mid-40s. You know, if you count the asterisked kind of Patino era runs, which I do because they actually happened, they have been a borderline dominant program, and they are just in a catastrophic nosedive, and somewhere Chris Mack is still cashing retirement checks from them and just enjoying whatever his day-to-day life looks like. But you know, they're projected to go 7-24 on the season by KenPom, and three of those wins are procedural. This is a team that's in an absolute death spiral, and if there's something worse than losing by 20 to Cincinnati on a neutral court, they're probably going to explore it when they get crushed at home to Maryland next week.
Got Kevin Willard's Terps coming to town. They've actually been very impressive so far this season, I've thought. So good for Kevin Willard. Way to go, Kevin. Yeah.
Avid listener.
Right. Obviously. First name basis over here. Even though you guys are all part of the Bald Guy Club with him, he likes me the best. I don't know what that says about all of us, but it's true. Yeah. So Georgetown is struggling. Yeah, I would argue with one part of that you're saying it's a developing plane crash, and I don't see how the plane has not already crashed. Like, this is carnage.
Maybe it's like an alive situation. How,
if the plane has not already crashed, what does it look like when it does?
Because Louisville.
That is, woo. Yeah. I mean, Cincinnati also found a hilarious way to lose a game this week, but anyway, we are back on to talking about Xavier. So a few questions here. The first one, obviously, against Indiana, what really kind of held Xavier back in that game was the defense. So is it the product of system or personnel with their defensive struggles thus far? I know Coach Miller said in his press conference that he has not felt like Xavier has put together a good defensive performance in any of their games thus far. And Indiana was just able to expose that the most, obviously, because they have the most talent. But is it the system or the personnel or a combination of both, Brad? What is holding Xavier back on defense?
I think the first thing to note is that the system has changed a little bit since last year. The high hedge that Xavier fans loved so much when Kenny Freese did it is back, and they're back to more of a pack line type defense, in the pure pack line rather than pack line principles that Travis Steele ran. So you will see Xavier sit off of that 3-point line a little bit after challenging hard out off the ball. That does make them a little bit more susceptible to quick rotation and somebody like Zach Fremantle getting caught one-on-one or against Indiana. They had a little bit of trouble when a ball went corner rotation and then came back. Nungy was getting sealed behind Trace Jackson Davis. To Mike Woodson's credit, he figured that out early. And you saw the Hoosiers go one rotation and then a quick ball switch and then an entry post pass. And that did create some problems. So that is partly down to the system, and that's just going to be how the system works. But not every team has Trace Jackson Davis. The other part is just personnel. Zach Fremantle's playing a lot better. He's been a lot more active on defense. He's still not very good on defense. Last year, that was really aggravating because he was not good on defense, and it looked like he didn't care that he wasn't good on defense. And this year, God bless him, he's trying his little heart out, and he just doesn't have the quickest feet in the world. I think Jack Nungy will have much better defensive games than he did against Indiana, but more than those two, it's the guards. Xavier just does not have a guard that can actually guard somebody. They may need to start calling them a different name, shooters or those guys who only play offense or something, because guarding has not really been high on the priority list for Sule Boom or Kiki Tandy or Adam Kunkel. Again, it hasn't looked like a lack of effort. They just can't stay in front of anyone, and Desmond Claude really has been struggling making the adjustment to guys that are as athletic and fast as he is. Until Xavier finds somebody who can defend on the outside, the defense is going to continue to struggle. Whether that means we'll end up with more of the 2-3 zone look that they showed Indiana, or they go to the 1-3-1 that Coach Miller ran his first time here, I don't know. Coach Miller also ran a 1-2-2 half trap in his first time at Xavier. So they might break that out, but they're going to have to do something because their guards just can't.
I think one of the kind of interesting knock-on effects, yeah, interesting as in it costs us games, knock-on effects of the guards not being able to defend on the ball is that it is really killing us on the defensive glass, because as soon as the team gets put in rotation by a guy getting beneath the free throw line, and, you know, Nungy or Fremantle or whoever's playing the four or the five has to step up, then that leaves opposing big men plenty of room to slip to the rim. And once a shot goes up, even if it's contested and it doesn't go in, just by virtue of having to step up to stop a driver, now our big men are out of position for, you know, stopping second chance points. I know Indiana killed us on the glass. Well, every game has been something less than a commercial for defensive rebounding so far for Xavier, but Indiana, like Brad said, they had the talent to take advantage of it, and they did. You know, the pack line defense is kind of a Miller staple, but we have not been very susceptible behind the arc. We're in the top 30 in terms of 3-point rate on defense. 3-point percentage is a less sunny picture, but I think the defense will improve just by virtue of the personnel getting more used to the system and guards doing a better job of staying in front. But until that happens, I think it makes our big men look worse than they are, especially on the defensive glass, and it makes us susceptible to follow on, you know, second chance points, which probably won't be a problem in the Big East against guys like Eric Dixon and Ryan Kalkbrenner and Adama Sanogo. It's probably going to be fine.
Probably. I would guess. Yeah, that is a concern when you look around the conference, certainly, you know, especially those three guys, and wonder how Xavier comes up with wins in those six games if they keep giving up defensive or offensive rebounds like they have been. But we talked a little bit about the guards, and defensively, obviously, it's been an issue. Brayden, who is Xavier's best backcourt at this point? So you've got, you know, Tandy and Boom and Kunkel and Claude. Thank you, Brad.
Well, Brad was very eager for that
said,
one. So
I said, Brayden, easy, calm down.
I will show
down, boy.
I will show Adam Kunkel some love. However, maybe not as much as Brad wants to. But so far this season, he's shooting just lights out. He's 64% inside the arc, 53% from behind it. If he keeps that up, we're going all the way. And you heard it here first. Another thing he does really well is he takes care of the ball. Sule Boom, I think that's the other part of our best backcourt duo right now. He's setting people up pretty well, but he's got issues with ball security, the issues that he sucks at it. But right now, he gets to the line a whole lot, and he knocks them down when he gets there. He's shooting respectably from inside the arc, and he's 61% from deep so far this year. That's Joel's just looking for clarification. That's pretty good. That's 16th in the country right now. And I think those are your two best. I mean, we've talked about the defensive issues. Both those guys have their shortcomings, but the numbers they're putting up on offense right now, I think, covers up some of that. I think Kunkel's a pretty versatile defender. He's not really going out there like Remy Abel or Nate Johnson and putting the clamps on somebody. And Boom's got quick hands on defense. He's able to get out and at least make the opposition point guard work a little bit before he gets blown by.
Yeah, I think Kunkel's versatile in that he's equally bad guarding all different types of players. I think he's really savvy off the ball. He's got good positioning, works passing lanes well, can move, you know, he does a good job digging in on big men. But if he gets ISO'd on a quick ball handler, that's not his strong suit. I think his offensive prowess probably makes him part of our best backcourt along with Sule Boom. But I am going to show some love to Kiki here because I think he is maybe our best backcourt defender. And he leads our guards in both steal percentage and block percentage. And you want a big rim protector at your number two. But he's in a lot of ways the exact opposite of Adam Kunkel on defense. You've seen him especially early in games look a little bit lost on rotation, get stuck between help and step up or drop to a shooter. He's given up some fairly uncontested layups in positions like that. But on the ball, he's done a much better job of keeping it out of the middle and keeping the pressure off of our big men to have to step up and stop drives. So like Brayden said, the way Kunkel has been shooting the ball, it's hard to keep him off the court. But if there is a way Kiki's going to keep him off the court, it's the fact that he can make a ball handler have to change directions.
I'll just throw out there that if we're at the point where Kiki Tandy is our best defending guard, we have something of an issue. He's been working hard. Man, I've loved getting to see him play. I think this is the Kiki that we were all hoping for the years that he was here. And I don't want to disparage him in any way, but he's not made his name defensively. And I would agree he's actually been our best on-ball defender, and that could potentially be part of the issue. Because like Brayden said, Sule Boom has quick hands, but he does not have quick feet defensively. He gets crossed easily.
Yeah, the thing I will say for Kiki, is that he does seem to have a nose for the ball. He does seem to be able to find it in loose ball situations or on defensive rebounds better than most. But yeah, I think maybe write the NCAA sixth year of eligibility for Nate Johnson. Who says no?
Probably Nate Johnson.
Probably Nate Johnson.
He's making money to play basketball right now.
He could NIL.
Dr. Nate Johnson.
I was going to say, let's pass the hat. Xavier fans, let's see what we can get done. Need him back. Anyway, according to metrics, Xavier is not appreciably better this year. According to one particular metric that Brad's going to bring up, they're much, much worse. But they're 34th in KenPom right now. After four games last year, they were 33rd. So that is a one rank difference, if I'm reading the math correctly here. I'm gonna have to go to some longhand here, so I'm gonna kick it over to Brad. Has your feeling about the program changed based on these two seasons, though?
So I think just to flesh things out a little bit, at this point in time last year, Xavier was sitting 4-0 and had just beaten Ohio State. And I think the way that the regular season ended really left a bad taste in everyone's mouth and kind of made people forget how well Xavier started the year. They at this point in time last year, everyone was optimistic about the team. Anybody telling you that they were down on the team at this point in time last year is either someone who's just a miserable human being to be around or is revising.
They're lying.
Xavier was in a great place last year. They had already racked up what would be a Q1 win. They had two Q4s and a Q3. So this year we don't know what the quadrants are going to be yet because the net hasn't come out. Indiana's looking like it'll be a Q1 loss. If you go by RPI, which is out right now, that's a Q2 loss. And then the wins are all Q4s. That's not a surprise to anybody. Xavier's not really scheduled that hard in those first three games. The one place where things are a lot different is if you take the Bart Torvik and wash out the projections. You can't do that with KenPom. You can with Bart Torvik. Wash out the projections. And last year at this point in time, Xavier was the 25th best team in the nation. This year, after four games, they're the 52nd best team in the nation. So just looking purely objectively at the numbers that are out there and available, Xavier's worse right now than they were
Come on,
last
it's a
year.
5-2 both years. You're just looking for a reason to complain.
But I think it's almost impossible to argue that the feeling of the fan base isn't that Xavier is in a better place this year. When I wrote this article, I did it with my usual amount of pot stirring intent and got even more than I bargained for. Xavier Nation strongly believes that this year's team is both better now and going to finish better than last year's. And I think a lot of that just comes down to how the feeling about the program has changed. If you look at the day before we played Florida last year, we were actually all together that day as well. I don't think Braden had arrived quite yet. We were walking in a Metro Park somewhere with no coach, having just barely scraped by Cleveland State and looking at a game in which it just felt for all the world like we were going to get hammered by Florida in the NIT.
Who also had no coach.
Who also had no coach, yeah. But then, obviously, then we had the news came through that Sean Miller had been hired. Jonas Hayes was going to coach that Florida game. Things changed a little bit. That was about 8 months ago, was the day before Florida. The last time we played Florida, you come to the day before Florida this time with Banter After Dark nearly crossing over the midnight hour here. And I think the feeling around the team has changed greatly. Everyone is optimistic. You could have scrolled through Twitter, and if you hadn't seen the result, based on the way people were talking about the game, thought we had beaten Indiana. And I thought that was interesting because we had an awful lot of people piling on with the, hey, at least we gave them a good game, and that's a good sign. I'm of the opinion that actually putting wins on the board is what matters, as opposed to just fancy L's. But the team, well, what do you guys think? How does your feeling about the program changed from this year or last year around Thanksgiving to this year.
First of all, I just tip of the cap to the Eeyore of Banner on the Parkway, Brad Dobney. Just does a great job of deflating any sort of positivity we might have had. Just if you're feeling good this year, remember last year you felt good too, and that ended up in a big old bucket of turds. Thanks for that reminder, Brad.
Life is pain, guys.
So Brad talked about washing out the numbers in a Torvik ranking right now. If you're not familiar with what that means, basically every system for projection comes in with some preseason assumptions based on returning personnel, the value of recruits and transfers, who the coach is, and the program's history. And then those inform where they rank the team's preseason and then how actual game action affects those rankings. And so basically what Brad's saying is take out all that information and just the blank slate and what's been played. Xavier's been the wrong side of the bubble this season. But I do agree that everybody's happier this year, and I think maybe the number one reason for that is that the team is more fun to watch. We are the sixth best three-point shooting team in the nation right now, shooting 44% from behind the arc. We're 18th in effective field goal percentage, 22nd in total adjusted offensive efficiency. You know, we've touched on it a little bit here, but there were just dark times during the Steel era where you grimace every time somebody lifted from behind the arc. And it seemed like even when the team started out mediocre from three, by the time February rolled around, they might as well be shooting them underhanded. You know, Travis Steele was kind of a polarizing hire in the beginning, and he only got more so as it went along. You know, by the time that his era was winding to a close, we spent a lot of time debating with people on Twitter whether or not he would be retained and indeed whether or not he should be retained. And obviously the question was, if you fire Steele, who do you bring back? And it turned out there was a pretty dang good option out there. So I think the number one reason for the difference in feeling around the program right now is that everybody trusts Sean Miller to do a good job and to turn this into a good team. He's proven that he can win at Xavier before. He's one of the guys who, when he left Xavier, Xavier fans kind of pined for him a little bit early in the Mac era. And then every time something went wrong during both the Mac and Steele regimes. So, you know, Travis Steele had a kind of a rocky first year, and he got Brian O'Connell out of probably an at-large bid. I think there's going to be a lot more grace given to Sean Miller early just because of the resume he's brought back to Xavier from both his first time at Xavier and his time at Arizona. And now he has hit the ground running with three fairly perfunctory victories and then going to toe-to-toe with a title contender with a team that's fun to watch and looks like they've got a pretty good idea of the game plan that they're trying to execute. So as long as you can ignore the fact that the top six players in our rotation probably won't be here next year, it's easy to look down the road and feel like this team's trending in the right direction.
Okay, Braden, can you say something positive that does not
without have immediately mitigating
like a trap door statement? It doesn't even have to be about Xavier.
It's about Thanksgiving, everybody.
Great weather today. I'll actually go positive right now. And Joel's right in that this team is a lot more fun to watch. And there's reason to hope that we're not going to just be dreading February, thinking that we're going to be wilting out of our at-large contention and then eventually losing to Butler in the first round of the Big East tournament again. Exactly. I mean, you know, you're looking forward. The Big East, it's not like loaded this year, but it's good, as it always is. It's the Big East. And you've got Sean Miller, who's, I don't know if you guys knew this, he played in the Big East back in the day. They've not brought that up at all. He played at Pitt for a while.
Get out of here.
Wait.
Yeah.
Pitt's not in the Big East.
No, they are not, because they are awful now. Like, talk about a fall from grace. But
we threw them out, took their best player ever.
Yeah, but you're looking down the conference and you're looking at a...
You're saying ACC legend Sean Miller.
Yes, ACC legend Sean Miller. You look at his track record. I mean, granted, he did have a year where he got bounced by an 11 seed in the Sweet 16, but so what does he know? But there's reason for optimism going into this year. I do actually have a question to circle it back to Joel. So we're sixth in the country in three-point percentage. You think we're fun to watch? I ask you the question, would we be more fun if we started shooting, I don't know, like 25, 30 of them a game? Because we're really good at it, as it turns out.
I don't know, but it's funny you should bring that up, because Travis Steele, now the coach of the Miami Redhawks, his team is 325th in the nation in three-point percentage, but they shoot 44% of their shots from behind the arc. So, Xavier, as we touched on just a minute ago, sixth in the nation, they shoot 26% of their shots from behind the arc. So they're 351st in three-point attempt frequency, and the Miami Redhawks are 57th. So keep hucking, boys. Maybe open your eyes next time.
Well, you know, he said it's going to be different guys on different nights, and so far it's been no guy on any night. So
that's not true.
Just wait for him.
They beat Goshen.
That's true. They're 0-4 in D1 games.
How did we spiral into...
We started steel bashing, and he's not even here anymore.
You said you wanted positivity, and the way we interpret that is being negative about something different.
I said something good.
Positively upgraded at coach. Somebody hit us in our mentions on Twitter today and was like, when is Travis Steele's name going to no longer be in Xavier Mouse? And then all we've done is bag on in this podcast. So whoever that was, sorry in advance when you listen to this.
Yeah, whatever. I think, honestly, when you... when you go out and hire one of the best coaches in the country, it's probably going to change the temperature around the program. I don't think it's rocket science here. Sean Miller's a fantastic coach, and he's proven it over the last two decades. And so, obviously, people are going to be happier.
But, Brian, what's a reason to be upset? You need to hop on the bandwagon.
What's here. A reason to be upset?
Yes.
Ooh, that Kunkel got rid of, like, the braids going into the man bun.
Oh, I love that look.
Yeah. That
it's got like a scruffy
honestly,
haircut going now.
Yeah,
it's nice.
Has probably ruined the season for me. But anyway, you know, other than that, I'm a pretty happy camper.
We have derailed.
Anyway, yeah. So let's cue theme music for Xavier Play of the Week. This week, obviously, since it's Thanksgiving, Bee Gees, To Love Somebody, all-time classic, great love song. Brad, which Xavier player does not know what it's like to love somebody the way you love him? This Bee Gees content, by the way, is really going to help us climb the podcast charts.
I tell you what, all the hip kids are listening to the Bee Gees.
The podcast generation is like, but why does no one talk about the Bee Gees?
We got it. I'm just going to leave all this laughter in general. It's Thanksgiving. We're all in a good mood, everyone. I hope you are wherever you're enjoying this. And I hope you're enjoying watching Adam Kunkel, my player of the week from last week. That's what we call professional segue right smooth. There. I didn't even take communication
goodness
as a major.
Sake.
My majors were totally useless.
Same.
Kunkel went for 34 points last week. And against Fairfield, he really came out and was the one who got the team going. He's been shooting exceptionally well. He kind of shook them out of their early game malaise against Fairfield. Unfortunately, against Indiana, he missed arguably the most important shot of the game. But I did like when we were watching that in my living room, I had a chance to watch that with my son. We were sitting there, and he said, I'd like to get something for Kunkel heading towards the bucket. And that was my thought. That appeared to be Sean Miller's thought as well. I think the team has a lot of faith in Kunk. Kunk has even more faith in himself than the team has. I would take him running towards the bucket anytime. He played really well last week. He's still only turned the ball over three times in four games. And he is the spark that the team needs. As much as we were talking about, he might be a member of the best backcourt. I actually like him not starting games. Coming off the bench, I think he does a really good job of changing the tempo, keeping intensity up if it's already there, or really raising the intensity when it needs to be. Because Kiki Tandy is kind of a, a mellow player. I don't mean that in any way negatively. He just is not very demonstrative. And when you replace him with the most demonstrative player on the roster, you usually get a big boost. That happened again this week. I think Kunk's going to bounce back from that miss against Indiana with a big game against Florida tomorrow.
All right. Braden, you did not get to name a Xavier Player of the Week last week. So why don't you tell us who yours is this week?
Mine is Zach Fremantle for this week. And I know Brad was praising Kunkel's ball security, but Fremantle managed to one-up him in only two games this week. He threw it to the wrong team 9 times. That's rather impressive in and of itself. But in that Fairfield game, he... why do you have to be negative? You're saying that's not a good thing? He's sharing with everyone. It's Thanksgiving, for gosh sake. But in that Fairfield game, he put up that triple-double. Obviously, didn't throw it to the right team all the time, but, you know, you'll take that. Or at least I will, because we won. And then against Indiana, I thought one of the most impressive things from him that game was when he caught that lob from Sule Boom and threw it down. That was impressive not only because he got way up there, but then after the officials had decided to start giving out stupid technicals to everyone who tried to celebrate, he showed incredible restraint by just mean mugging the dude he'd punched on and not picking up a cheap tech when he was having one of the best games of anybody on the court. He still went for 15, pulled in 6 boards, 3 assists, and threw in a few turnovers because sharing is caring. And he also blocked a shot. So I thought his contributions in that Indiana game were huge. He stayed within himself on offense and then threw it down on somebody, and that was fun to watch.
Okay, Joel, do you agree with either of those options?
I do. I agree with what Brad said about Kunk coming back with a big game against Florida. I don't know that he'll necessarily have a big production outing, but I promise you he's going to give himself every chance to shoot himself into that game. But I am going to agree with Braden that Zach Fremantle is our player of the week. Obviously, the triple-double against Fairfield is fun. Braden covered most of the good stuff. So I'm just going to do a couple quick hits on Fremantle. The first thing that I'm impressed by is that he's currently 0-for-1 from behind the arc this year. That's what we need out of Zach Fremantle. Not the 0 so much, but certainly the 1. Just don't, man. And he has leaned into the good parts of his skill set and leaned out of the ones that are detrimental to the team. And I might be kind of wish casting here, but I think that's probably down to having a coach who's not afraid to suspend him in the preseason if he's not falling in line. And the other thing is, out of the 80 minutes that Xavier played last week, Zach Fremantle played 75 of them. He led the team in minutes against Fairfield. He led the team in minutes against Indiana. That's tough to do for any player. It's especially tough to do for a big man. When you've got a big guy who's able to be productive, and Zach certainly has been, he's been getting after it in the paint, playing good defense, not entirely staying out of foul trouble, but keeping it from crippling him. And, Sean Miller's just saddling him up, Ben Bentel style, and riding him till the wheels fall off. So, other than the statistical contributions, just the fact that basically you can write him into the scorebook in ink and leave him out there for nears makes no difference the whole game and trust that he's going to have his numbers at the end without having fouled himself out of the game or undermined the team's efforts. I think that deserves recognition. And Sean Miller recognized it with 75 minutes, and I'm recognizing it by giving him my player of the week.
I wonder which of those mean more to him.
Let's wait until he listens.
Debatable, I was going to say. I bet oftentimes when he's getting ranted at by a coach, he's like, yeah, but I bet the Banners guys love that.
These guys all just huddle around their phone when the podcast drops, and they're like, fast forward to the Player of the Week section. Let's see what music they intro to this week.
Well, I feel like they're probably going to be horrified. That's not true. None of them listen. I actually have also gone with Adam Kunkel. It is rare that someone has a triple-double and is not the KenPom MVP. I don't know that I've ever seen that before, but Zach Fremantle did pull that off. Ball security is a big issue for this team. And Adam Kunkel has a lot of the ball without turning it over, and I think that's incredibly valuable. It was especially valuable against Fairfield when Xavier did not have Colby Jones, who is usually a steadying force on offense, and Adam Kunkel really kind of drug them through that first half. There was like a seven-minute stretch where Xavier did not score a field goal that Adam Kunkel didn't either score or assist. So, he had a huge hand in Xavier kind of keeping their heads above water in a game that at times felt like it was getting away. One of those times being when they were down by 10 points, but other times as well. Against Indiana, obviously, he had the one bucket not go in that I think he probably everyone was willing in, but he still had a very solid showing off the bench, and again, three assists to one turnover. I just think that the ability to take care of the ball is going to be extremely valuable to this Xavier team. And he has, along with Jones, has displayed that ability. And since I can't give Player of the Week to Colby Jones since he didn't play in one of the games, I have to give it to Adam Kunkel.
You could, probably.
Yeah, but it's my own personal rule. I have to look at myself in the mirror, guys. Let's be honest. I mean, anyone who's seen me knows that looking in the mirror is not
that's a heavy enough burden to carry.
No, it's 'cause, like, you know.
Man of integrity, though.
Right. I'm, you know, I'll know. Anyway, you know.
I wanted to say one thing about that Kunkel miss, because a couple people asked us on Twitter about basket interference. And the rule is that, because an Indiana player very clearly did grab the net when that ball was around the cylinder or something. And I, of course, immediately yelled basket interference because I did not want to believe that Adam Kunkel had just missed a right-handed layup. The rule is that the grabbing of the net must have an impact on the ball. And that is a referee discretion call, which can be reviewed inside the last 2 minutes. The referees apparently decided that that grabbing the net had not had any impact on the flight of the ball or whether it was going to go through the cylinder. And after I watched the replay, I had to agree with them. But that was one thing that had come up a couple times on Twitter. So just to clarify that, that was not basket interference, unfortunately.
Glad you clarified that, because
are you guys done being juvenile here?
I was hoping they would reopen the case and give Xavier the win.
I would like that.
I'd even take a draw.
Yeah.
Well, my lawsuit actually mentions that, so we'll see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Emotional damages, obviously. Your son was there. How are you supposed to explain that to him?
Why I was crying on the floor.
Like, you know, how do you put your kids to bed after something like that? I wouldn't know.
Angrily.
I was gonna say, I'd probably just be like, just go. You know where it is. So our final quick hit, something Joel brought up because he cheers for Germany in the World Cup, and they have a lot of players that everyone, including apparently some of their own fans, hates. So a player on your favorite team that you have hated, Joel, obviously, you get to lead off here, because you've got us kind of on the subject.
All right. Yeah. I'm going to strike while the iron is hot and say freaking Kai Havertz. He is not a number 9. I don't know why they keep putting it up there. He's not good at soccer, at least not in that position. They should be starting Füllkrug. He is an out-and-out striker. For a while, he was the Bundesliga's leading scorer. He's second now, 10 goals and 2 assists, playing for Werder Bremen, who's not exactly a giant. You know, if he can put up those numbers, maybe if we put him in front of the 32 tricky midfielders that Germany runs out there and feed balls into the box, we'll have better results against World Cup powerhouses like Japan. I want to also take this time to issue a formal apology to somebody who was the president of the club of favorite team players that Joel hates, and that's Mario Gomez. Much like Mario Gomez, he was starting at number 9 in front of a guy who played for my favorite club. How the tables have turned, Mario. I'm sorry for all the horrible things that I said about you. I'm sure you felt them, even if you didn't hear them. I would give Kai Havertz to have you back right now. At least you were an actual striker. I was blinded by my love for Miroslav Klose, who is a lot better than you and the most prolific World Cup scorer in history. But I shouldn't have said those things that I said. I hated you unrightfully. But also, Kai Havertz, you're never going to get this apology until my dying day. You're ruining Thanksgiving for me, Kai.
Here's what I will say for Mario Gomez. He did not have a rat face.
That's true.
That is something you cannot say for Kai Havertz.
I'm pretty certain that Joel at some point in time did say that he had a rat face, because he certainly insulted literally every other part of him.
Oh, I'm sure he mentioned Mario Gomez having a rat face at some point, but he doesn't. And like Kai Havertz physically resembles a rat. So anyway, Braden, what do you got?
Nothing to top that, as it turns out. My gosh, there's some venom behind that. But I've gone with Roberto Perez of the Cleveland, formerly Indians, now Guardians, because for the entire time he was there, he did nothing but take up a roster spot and steal money. I didn't hate him with the same vigor that Joel hates Kai Havertz, because I didn't think he was a bad dude. But he definitely sucked the paint off the walls on a few Indians teams that could have used another bat in the lineup. He was a much below average hitter. He was praised for his defense, which I could not care less about. Because you need to hit bombs to win games, kids. I don't care how good your catcher's arm is. Nobody steals anymore, except for the guys that do. And even then, you're not going to throw them out most of the time. So, Roberto Perez, ugh. We were very close, and if we'd had a catcher that could have maybe hit, I don't know, anything north of 200 in 2016... we might have gotten there. So
we did. He was hurt.
Yeah, that's
also
fair.
Roberto Perez won us one of the games in the World Series.
Well, I don't care about that, Brad.
He got four contracts off of one hit.
I came up with this on the spot. He did nothing but steal money for the time after 2016, after he hit two home runs in game one and did nothing the rest of the series. So not the same venom behind Joel's, but golly, I hated to see him suiting up for us.
Okay, Brad, it feels like we need a boost here.
Then we probably shouldn't have picked this topic for the last quick hit.
Well, no, I'm saying that was not very hateful. Braden was like, seemed like a nice guy. I need you to bring the hate.
Well, I have at various points in time probably hated everyone who plays for my favorite teams, because I've been described as the cousin who's closest to me as a little ball of hate, which is probably fair. I hate everyone. I was going to go with John Rocker, but then I thought everybody probably hates John Rocker. That's not very original. Then I was going to go with this year's entire Cleveland Browns roster, because I hate all of them. What a disappointment to both me and their mothers. Whoa. They are.
You can't hate Nick Chubb.
I don't hate Nick Chubb, but I have disassociated him in my mind with this roster because he doesn't deserve to be lumped in with the sack of garbage that the rest of this team is. I think it's hilarious that somebody turfed the field with a golf cart. I wish they'd used a semi-truck. that stupid elf is in the middle of the field. What is even going on there? It's just dumb. This whole team sucks. I hate them. Bring back Baker, who I liked and was at least entertaining. These guys are a load of crap. But that's not even the most virulent I can be about this team.
Yes!
Because Deshaun
Watson... The king is back, baby!
Deshaun Watson is on this team, and he's a despicable human being. We've given him the most money ever. I'm starting to get sweaty just thinking... Not unlike Deshaun Watson at a massage.
No. Do we need to get you into a corner?
I despise that guy. He's an awful human being. We've given him the most guaranteed money in NFL history. He's just a wretched person. He refuses to apologize for being a wretched person. For some reason, the people in Cleveland who are so just sycophantically desperate for a winner insist that it's okay that we've brought this piece of human garbage into our franchise. I hope he plays. I hope he gets hurt the very first play he plays. I hope it's a career ender and super painful. I hope Jimmy Haslam comes down on the field and then for some reason somebody hurts him too.
He is getting in there.
I should probably stop.
I was gonna say. Louise.
At least when Baker woke up feeling dangerous, that didn't mean you had to hire another security guard for the physiotherapist.
Oh, God. Yeah. I liked Baker. That's my contribution. Guys, I don't watch very much football. I'm going to go with Joey Barton because he was a bad person. Just kidding. I loved him. I'm never going to apologize for that. I'm actually going to go with Michael Brantley. This is a rant I've been on, but the people haven't heard it, and now I'm going to go for it. Michael Brantley, former Cleveland Indian / Guardian, whined until he got put on the 2017 postseason roster, went 0 for 900 that postseason, basically single-handedly cost us that series against the Yankees.
That's a lot of wasted ABs.
And then, yeah, he actually batted like twice every time through the order, and the Yankees never called us on it because they wanted him up because he's awful. Then the next year we got knocked out by the Astros, who everyone know who knew was cheating. So what's he do? He goes and signs with the Astros to try and get a cheap ring. It did not work the first like four times he tried it, but he did get it this year. I wish him nothing but I hope he's unhappy with that ill-gotten ring that he knows he got by cheating. I'm convinced the Astros are still cheating. There's no way they're not. Anyway, a lot of players leave Cleveland, and I cheer for them. Yan Gomes, as Drubal Cabrera, they were my guys, but not Michael Brantley. So that's it for us. Thank you guys so much for listening. We hope you guys have a great Thanksgiving with friends and family, and we will be back with you guys next week to talk about Xavier at the Film Night Invitational.